Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast on How to Be Wrong, hosted by John Cogg and myself, John Traphagen. The other John's not available today, so I'm going to be going solo on our journey into the nature and experience of intellectual humility and the value of getting it wrong. Today, I am really delighted to have as our guest Dr. Ken Wiesian, who is a geophysicist and associate director in the Environmental Division of the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, where I also happen to work. Previously, Ken was a senior state executive responsible for disaster recovery, oil spill prevention and response, and coastal infrastructure and environmental protection for Texas. And as an officer in the United States Air Force, Major General Wiesian participated or led military disaster response efforts for the Shuttle Columbia crash and multiple hurricanes. He also flew as a bombardier in B-52s and many other aircraft and is a graduate of the United States Air Force Test Pilot School. Ken, it's great to have you on How to Be Wrong.
It's a pleasure, John. I think the approach to the questions y'all ask is really refreshing and original, so I'm looking forward to diving into this.
Me too. It should be a fun conversation. So I'd like to begin just by asking you if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, you've got a pretty interesting background. I have not run into too many doctor major generals before. And so I'd like to know a little bit about kind of how you, you know, took the path you took and you know, sort of you've had a variety of different kinds of leadership roles in the military and education and government. And I'm curious, you know, has your career followed kind of a straight path? Have you had a circuitous route? So, you know, if you just tell us a bit about that.
Sure. That's a lot of questions there. I call my career path kind of a random walk or a Brownian motion kind of thing. I never had a plan as such beyond very general terms of I wanted to be a scientist and I wanted to be a military flyer. And I bounced around between the two for my whole career, but it was really driven initially growing up, getting into science fiction and just loving science fiction along with military history. And I've constantly bounced back and forth between the two ever since. My professional career started in the Air Force. I was here at University of Texas. I was an undergraduate physics major in ROTC. And I was going to be a scientist in the Air Force till my senior year when I just said, no, I got to fly, and switched over to a flying slot. I was already wearing glasses at that time, so I didn't become a pilot. But I became a navigator and bombardier, ended up spending 30 years in the cockpit out of 33 total years in the military, which is also a fairly neat thing. Participated in three wars, did all kinds of interesting flying. And, you know, kind of surprised myself at the end by popping out the top as a major general. But we can get into some of those aspects later. And then after that, I wanted to get back into science. I'd gotten my PhD while I was in the military. I kind of bounced back and forth also between full-time military and part-time military. I did my PhD back in the early 90s. And flew part-time for the military. Then after a while, I realized I couldn't be as good at both careers at the same time as I wanted to be. So I went back to full-time military to finish my career. Once I was done with that in 2015, started trying to find my way back into the academic world, which wasn't terribly easy, but eventually did. And now I'm happily being a scientist.
Yeah, it's actually very interesting that you raise sort of the lack of a plan. And I think it's interesting that people often look at, you know, very successful people like yourself. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of major generals in the world, and you have a PhD. I think people tend to assume, oh, well, there must have been a plan, you know, that you were aiming at something. And often that's not the case. It's just kind of things go where they go.
No, and a lot of people do plan that, but I personally feel like if you start out young in life, whatever, you know, if you're in the military, the people I've seen who as junior officers in the military have their life goal set on becoming a general often end up bitter and burnt out. I always concentrated, whether in any area, on doing the job I'm in as best as I can, and doors of opportunity always opened as a result of that.
Yeah, that's how I've always looked at it too. I've never really known where I'm going, but it seems that if I sort of stay focused on the present, what I'm doing, a lot of interesting things happen. And I certainly never imagined I'd be doing what I do right now, but it just kind of, that's the way it went.
And concentrating on having fun. You know, I know a lot of people that are in jobs they don't really like because they feel they're supposed to be there. I've turned down positions that most people would go, why'd you do that? Yeah, because it wasn't what I was interested in. You have to love what you're doing to put in the hard work to be good at it without just getting burnt out.
Yeah, fun is a really important component of it. And if it isn't fun, whatever you get out of it doesn't last that long, in my view.
No, in fact, I've always enjoyed, especially when I was in uniform, telling people, and as a colonel and as a general in the upper ranks, my three priorities were always, priorities were take care of people and get the mission done. That's line number one. You have to keep those balanced. A lot of people put one above the other. Two, be safe. Even in combat, there's still safety rules. They may be a little looser, but they're still there. But the third thing, which usually surprised people, is have fun. You know, if you don't look forward to coming into work, at least most days, do something about it. Inject some fun into the place.
Yeah, I think fun and humor is an important component of things as well. You have to be able to laugh at things. And a lot of people can't, particularly people have a hard time laughing at themselves. So, given your background, I'm going to guess that you've had more than a few experiences with things that have gone wrong or not the way really were planned. So I was wondering if you could, share maybe an interesting example of this with our audience. I'm curious how you might think assumptions or preconceived ideas contributed to the problem, and how does this relate to, how we engage in leadership?
Oh, yes. There's a lot of examples I could pull out. We'll see where this goes, but I'll give you an example in my own case, and I've got more I can draw on. I've certainly made errors or screwed things up multiple times. Fortunately, never got anyone hurt from that. But one of the ones that sticks out in my mind is as a fairly new bombardier in B-52s. In that aircraft, it's a bomber. It has two pilots, two navigators, a gunner, and electronic warfare officer, at least it did back when I flew them. The two navigators are much like a pilot co-pilot. You start off in the junior position in the right side. You move to a senior position on the left side. I had upgraded to the left side, which is kind of the bombardier position. The most dangerous time for most flyers is 6 months after a year after you're checked out in a new position. Because at that point, you're starting to think, yeah, I know what I'm doing. I'm good. And I was in that position about 6 months after getting checked out. We were on a normal training run over the center of the U.S. I think it was up in Nebraska, doing a bomb run that I'd done many times before. But, you have to do certain things. You have to practice a certain number of times without some of your equipment. I said, yeah, I'm good. I'm going to turn off this piece, and this piece, and I'm still going to do the bomb run. Well, I got thoroughly lost over the center of Nebraska in a training mission. It was highly embarrassing. I had to ask the electronic warfare officer to jam the scoring site so we wouldn't get a bad score as a crew. And, that kind of brought me back down to earth and made me quite humble, and was a valuable lesson on not getting overconfident. So I thought that was a big one. I've had others. Another one that stands out in my mind as a lesson learned as much as being in error. Let me back up a little bit. Again, being a science fiction nerd and a geek, I was always interested in the space program. I was stationed at Edwards Air Force Base, California for a number of years, and that's where the shuttle used to land regularly. In fact, at my house on base, you could hear the double sonic boom of it coming back in, and turn on the TV and you'd be able to see it landing in a few minutes. You got used to that. I was also a finalist for astronaut in the 90s. I had to pull out of it because I was a single parent at the time and couldn't swing the workload. But there are people around me, before me and after me and in my class at test pilot school became astronauts. Test pilot school is kind of a fighter, astronaut lead-in program. So the bottom line is I'm fairly familiar with the shuttle, its reentry and all that. Well, the shuttle Columbia, I forgot what year it was, coming back in over the U.S., I knew it was coming overhead. And I actually turned on and watched it on TV, if I remember right. And I remember seeing the trail of it look not right. I knew immediately something didn't look right in that. And so I basically headed into my unit, which is in Fort Worth. It's a C-130 transport unit. And by the time I got there, there were a couple other people arriving who kind of sensed that something was wrong. And pretty soon the phone rang from Washington, D.C. saying, get up in the air, get over East Texas and start doing a search and rescue, because the shuttle Columbia had broken up over Texas. And my first question was, okay, what's the fund site for this? Who's paying for this? Which I was deeply conditioned into doing. You never fly a military aircraft without knowing the authorization, who's paying for it, all that, because technically it's a felony to do that. They didn't have an immediate answer. I don't remember exactly what it was. I called up my higher commander, the wing commander, said, look, here's what's happening. I'm getting told this. What should I do? He said, basically, get your rear end up in the air. And we got up there and we were the first aircraft on site, along with a couple of fighters that joined us almost the same time, spotting the little smoke trails coming up all over East Texas. But I never forgot after that, you know, sometimes you just have to make the call and take the risk and go. And I've never hesitated since then to go, look, I'll do this on my authority. It's okay if I lose my job. If I'm confident it's the right thing to do, I'm going to do it. And so, and, you know, it's kind of a mistake. It didn't make a difference in that case, but it was a valuable, valuable lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose, you know, had things been a little bit different, it could have been a difference between life and death of somebody that was on the shuttle. But that's a hard thing to do because, you know, we tend to live inside of the framework of the rules that are set for us. And it's hard to know when the right moment is to push through those and say, okay, I've just got to go and do this thing that has to be done.
Mm-hmm. And that's on an organizational level. It involved multiple people. I had a similar lesson just for my own that stuck with me from early in my training. Also, as a B-52 Navigator Bombardier, it's the only aircraft in the inventory that has ejection seats that shoot out the bottom of the aircraft for the two navigators. What that means is, whereas the rest of the crew can safely eject, even if you're on the runway at high speed, if the navigators eject, you basically punch into the ground right in front of the main wheels, which isn't a good thing. So, I had very wise, older, more experienced flyers tell me, you've got to make your own decision there. If the plane gets into a bad situation, you have to decide when to leave, even though the technical procedure is you ask the pilot for permission to eject, and then if he says yes, you eject. I resolved in my mind that if it ever came to that, that recall to eject was just a courtesy call because that meant I was on my way out because I have less time to react than anyone else. And that was another one of those key decision points where it actually translated into the integrity side of my thinking. Even though it was a physical decision, somehow that morphed into a resolve that, you know, I'd never sacrifice my integrity. I'm quite willing to leave my career behind in my wings if it came to that.
So that brings me to a question about, you know, how this intersects with how we function as leaders. And, you know, obviously you've had enormous experience as a leader. And I'm curious, you know, how do you think these experiences that, you know, where things did go wrong or at least forced you to think about what would happen if things go wrong. How do you think they shaped your development in terms of your career as an officer and ultimately, you know, being in leadership positions in the Air Force or elsewhere?
Yes. Well, they're pivotal things. I mean, the fact that they're still vibrant in my memory today after 20 plus years in some cases shows their emotional impact on you. And I'd imagine that's the same for everybody. You can study all you want. You can read about leadership. Practicing it makes the difference. And it's a continual journey. I still learn new things about leadership, mostly from practice, on a regular basis, even at my advanced age. You never stop. And someone who stops learning is a problem, really. So, yeah, they're pivotal moments. They kind of shock you into an awareness, a self-awareness frequently that's key. That's missing in a lot of folks. So it's that experiential learning, like most things, that really drives home the point. Now, on leadership, I still do a lot of reading, and reading case studies, history, that kind of thing is very helpful and important for development. But if that's all you ever do and you never put it into practice, then that's a problem. And it, within that context, also, you need room to learn, to make errors. That's an important thing. I'd be happy to go into that. But,
yeah,
you know,
please.
A one-mistake organization will fail due to people being risk-averse, not adapting and such. In fact, some of the world events these days are kind of showing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the one of the things that, you know, comes up, is it was interesting as you were talking, I was thinking about the value in being humbled is that it really forces you to, you know, kind of think about, all right, were there different ways I could have dealt with this? And what do I do when I'm, you know, facing this kind of problem in a position when I'm leading, or, you know, someone else winds up being humbled? It sort of sets a trajectory. But if you only focus on sort of the reading side of things and you don't get out there and have that practical experience, in some ways you never really get humbled. You just learn a whole lot of stuff and think you know a whole lot of stuff.
True. You know, everyone needs role models, and mine tend to be those less flashy, quiet leaders. And there are examples of them in the military. And that's, since having spent 33 years of my life in the military, that's still kind of my dominant area that I think of in these terms of leadership. Although, you know, it's been interesting to get into the academic world and see that there. I'd also seen it before in the medicine world, for instance, where there's a lot of overconfidence. You know, you have very intelligent people, but people who've never been trained or practiced at leadership, and suddenly you're in a leadership position and you find out that just raw smarts isn't a good guide to success.
Yeah. Yeah. A long time ago, you and I were chatting and you said something to me that has always stuck with me as being quite interesting. I remember exactly what the topic was, but I made a comment about, you know, sort of giving orders. And I think you said something along the lines of, you know, as an officer, you had only given orders a couple of times in your whole career along the lines of you must do this sort of thing. And I thought that was really intriguing because it's very different from the stereotype and image, of course, we have of the military. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and, you know, why was that the case and how do you think about that?
Sure. Yes. Well, let me first preface that with different parts of the military have very different cultures. I came from the Air Force, which is the most collegial, I would say, of the services. And it's for very valid reasons. The Army is a much more forceful command organization when you've got to order people to take that hill kind of thing. The Air Force structure, I think, comes back to the fact that the frontline shooters in the Air Force are the officers, all the way up through colonel and sometimes general, Myself as a full colonel, which is one step below general, was still flying regular combat missions, flying the line. So you have this collection of educated officers, each given an aircraft to do a mission, and it's a lot more of a cooperative thing. But that extends throughout the culture in general terms with some variations. So that background plus the background of Hollywood gives you a gross misconception of military leadership. You know, there are people that are kind of like that, the fire-breathing role. They sometimes make the top levels. It gets complicated on there. There's definite drawbacks to it. But having said that, I'm trying to think. I was never forcefully given an order in my entire career of something I didn't want to do. If you're well-trained and educated, you lay out the objectives and what needs to be done, and everyone knows that's what needs to be done. So in actuality, in my career, I only had to give a forceful order one time. And that was not in combat. I was in three wars, but everyone knows what you're doing. You have the mission, you give it out, everyone studies. That's just the way it is. The one time I did was during a hurricane response here in Texas with one of my forward units that was charged with essentially riding out the storm as close as they could to an airfield so that once the storm was passed, they could go in, open up the airfield, and get relief supplies flying in and out. Well, they were assigned to shelter in a National Guard armory that was rated to hurricane level 2 or so, I think, which was more than enough for where it was. But they were the leader of that organization was hesitant to stay there. The windows were already rattling and such. He wanted to bug out farther, and I said, "Yeah," I said, "No, your job is to stay there. The building is rated safe. Now, if you really feel like you are unsafe," I would never overrule a commander on the spot. If he had decided, yeah, you know, it's falling down, we got to get out of here, I would have backed him. But I told him pretty forcefully that, look, this is your job. Here's the conditions. It's been sorted out. You've got to stay there. And he did come around to seeing it that way, and everyone was fine, and then they were able to do their job once the storm has passed. But that's the only time I did that. And in my career, like I said, I was never given a situation like that that I didn't already know that I needed to do it. I was only yelled at once in my career, and frankly, I deserved it that time.
What did you do?
No.
Not going to tell us that. Huh?
No. I deserved it. It was after a night of a wild squadron party where everyone was in trouble. Okay. This is a long time ago, too. When you have a bunch of young 20-somethings, sometimes common sense doesn't prevail. In fact, it's amazing, that I'm still here. When you give five young 20-somethings the keys to a nuclear bomber and say, you know, go out and fly this around the world or something, it's just stunning we didn't have more crashes.
I never really thought of it that way before, but that's actually a very frightening thought when you raise it quite that way. That I assume that are there usually someone older than a 20-something on a nuclear bomber, I would hope.
Well, that's a very good leadership thing. This isn't into mistakes, but one of the best things I ever saw. Active duty crew force is a pretty young crew force. It is mostly 20-somethings with a sprint, you know, typically in a squadron, a few 30-somethings and one or two 40-somethings at the top of a squadron. So the flyers are pretty young. And in the National Guard, they're significantly more experienced. But active duty is where the bombers were. And occasionally you get an all-lieutenant crew just because there's not enough captains to go around. So, you know, lieutenant is between 21 and maybe 24. And sure enough, at one point I was on an all lieutenant crew. The squadron commander did a brilliant thing. What he did was he assigned the senior most gunner in the squadron, and the gunners were enlisted, so sergeants. outranked by every lieutenant on the crew, but you put the senior-most sergeant on that crew as the leveling influence, as the adult supervision. The senior sergeant was probably late 30s. And, you know, unless you're a complete idiot, when a senior sergeant kind of says, hey, lieutenant, what about this? Or did you consider this? You will listen to them and they'll keep you out of trouble, both in the air and on the ground. And then later on, when I became, you know, a squadron and group level commander, I did exactly the same thing. It's one of the most brilliant things around, to put that senior enlisted person on a crew of officers to kind of be the adult supervision.
That's fascinating. And it actually really comes around to this sort of question of humility and kind of intellectual humility, in the sense that, you know, if you think strictly in terms of rank, well, the lieutenants outrank that sergeant, right? But if you think about experience and then factor that in, then it's a very different kind of calculation. It's a different way to think about things.
That's a very good point. I've never thought of it expressly in terms of humility, but you're spot on that.
Yeah, I think it's intriguing, because it really says, all right, you know, I'm literally higher status than this guy. And yet we've got to focus on a different way of thinking about things in terms of emphasizing experience, because when it comes to experience, that sergeant is really much higher status than a lieutenant, regardless of the rank. It's intriguing.
You know, in the medical world, it might be a nurse versus a brand new doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same situation can arise. So I would imagine it can occur in most fields.
So do you think lieutenants would ever get pissed off by something like that?
Oh, yes. I mean, some just didn't have the common sense to listen in situations like that. But even if you're smart, at first you might have a kind of a knee-jerk reaction in opposition. But again, you know, a smart person will go, oh, wait a minute, what am I doing here? You know, the alarm bell should ring in the back of your head. And frankly, in most of your training, and I think this applies to all the military services, it's drummed into you pretty hard to listen to that senior enlisted person, because they have that wisdom and experience.
Yeah, and I think it also points out, you know, use the word being, you talked about being educated, but that does not mean having sat in a classroom with books. It means, it can mean that, but, you know, the lieutenant who has gotten a college degree and, you know, went through ROTC and all that, that individual knows quite a bit, but that's not the same kind of education as that sergeant who's been out there doing this.
Correct. Think of it like a engineering professor working on a car versus who they can be quite dangerous.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And
oh, I know how this works in theory.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's also that's where we easily kind of get into this. You know, we have a kind of the status hierarchies of our society tend to lead us to think that we ought to be in a position of authority or power, even if we don't actually necessarily have the corresponding knowledge that should put us in that position. If we have the title, we sort of deserve it.
Yes, a lot of people think they have to act in a leadership role, I think. They can't admit an error. And again, you see that all around you all the time. But that's false. I mean, one of the I think the most sincere things you can do is admit you're wrong as a leader. And I've done that. You know, if you're repeating the same errors, then that's a problem. And if you're wrong, you know, very frequently, that's a problem. But showing that you will listen and your mind is open to changing your conceptions, I think is absolutely critical.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's critical to leadership. I think it's critical to just living, basically. And also being open to, you know, people who are quote unquote in subordinate positions, or in positions where they have, you know, lower rank or something like that, to sort of be able to remove the status hierarchy. And, you know, the military is fascinating because there's a very clear cut status hierarchy. But to be able to remove that and say, no, this person actually, he knows better than I do about this.
Yes. And it's not about formal leadership positions either. You know, some of the best leaders are behind the scenes leaders who don't have a position of authority, but they motivate people. They get people moving in the right direction. So, you know, an organization being successful isn't just about the leader. It's about the entire organization, the entire culture, and how everyone combines.
Yeah, and so this kind of brings me around to my next question I wanted to kind of dive into. And early on in this podcast, we the issues of politics have come up a little bit, but we haven't really gone too far into them. But I found that with the current situation in Ukraine, I keep thinking a lot about this question of intellectual humility and humility in general. And I'm curious, you know, how do you think embracing a more humble approach to leadership, for example, might influence the ways we approach political conflict, you know, as a planet or as a, you know, just the United States, when we have all of these different political, cultural, religious groups and everything engaged in, you know, trying to deal with each other? And of course, I think you have a unique position because you've actually been in conflict. You've been in battle and, you know, seen first, you know, right up front what happens when these groups come into, you know, military conflict. So I'm curious what you think about that.
Yes. Well, first of all, it maybe it's to some degree always been this way, but it feels like no one in a public position is allowed to admit they were wrong or to change their minds. And the polarization is just off the scale. You know, here in the U.S., if you reach towards the middle from either side, you're not going to get blasted from across the aisle. You're going to get blasted from behind, from your own party. That's not good for the future. So there is that aspect of it. This may be a little tangential, but I occasionally speak or teach leadership. And one of the things I always bring up is one of my favorite books, The History of the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides. This was written, you can probably tell me better than I can remember, but somewhere in the 300 BCs, I believe. It's one of the earliest, it's one of the earliest works of history, and especially of accurate military history and military and political history. If you read Thucydides, then what you will see is over the maximum span of recorded human history, nothing about politics, warfare, or human nature has changed. And I think that is a very enlightening perspective to have. Yes, our culture changes a lot. Our technology changes. But those human failings, biologically, we haven't changed a bit in many, many thousands of years. So, you know, that realization that nothing about these human natures, and that gets back to leadership and such, has changed. And I just think that's a very grounding perspective when you're looking around the modern world, looking at, well, how can I be a good leader? What is humility and all that? It's not a perfect guide from the ancients, and there's very good modern research that illuminates key questions more. But it's a great place to start and ground yourself. So
why do you think that's the case? Do you think it's our biology? And the one thing that struck me as you were saying is I was thinking, in all of that history has largely been run by men fighting wars, which is kind of interesting too. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's just something we can't seem to shake?
It's just opinion and guesswork, but, you know, we are still physiological, biochemical beings. And again, you can look at the DNA sequences. We haven't changed. We have not evolved in that time. We're healthier. We have education. We have other things. But that hard wiring hasn't changed, and it is still a significant driver. that can't be ignored. So, you know, aggression, unfortunately, competition, xenophobia appear to be even maybe more basic than Homo sapiens. It might be basic to a more fundamental level of life. And life everywhere does seem to be essentially infinitely competitive. Now, hopefully, you know, there is some evidence that we are slowly becoming a less violent world, to, you know, current news notwithstanding. But if you average it up, it looks that way. But those things don't change. And your brain will trick you into thinking you're much more logical than you are. One of my other favorite books is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. He's a psychologist who won the Nobel in economics, I think much to the annoyance of economists. But he has an excellent book. It's over a decade old now, but it's still quite good. That really goes into detail on explaining how the different parts of your brain will serve up things to your consciousness that seem perfectly rational, but are very definitely not. And I think it's a good enlightening book for, again, starting that basic self-awareness of, oh, maybe I should look at how I think a little more, because I'm probably making judgment calls that aren't nearly as factual as I think.
So you've used the term self-awareness a couple of times. Would you equate that with, say, intellectual humility? Do you think those two things are connected?
I definitely do. Mm. If you are self-aware, and no one's perfectly self-aware by any means, but if you do put time, energy, and effort into developing that, I think you can't help, but I think it correlates very closely with humility. They're not completely congruent, but I think there's a pretty strong overlap there.
Yeah, I agree. I think that a degree of self-reflexiveness, being able to look at oneself and say, I didn't think of that the right way, or I didn't do that the right way, or these are my assumptions that seem to be aiming me in a particular way. I think that's the starting point.
Yeah, it goes back to some very old quotes. Mm-hmm. Know thyself is a great one.
Yep.
And the unexamined life is not worth living.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's really not exactly rocket science. Humans have known this for a long time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We just struggle. We struggle with being able to somehow put it into action.
You know, the role of myth in developing self-awareness, I think, is fascinating too. A whole separate conversation. But, how do you acculturate people who are becoming adults, those kinds of things? There's a lot of wisdom in the old ways. There's a lot of problems that are rooted in deep old cultures, and no culture is perfect by any means. Almost every culture has had slavery at some point in its past. So, you know, the past, I use the past as informative, but it shouldn't be a straitjacket. The same as people who study military history, you study campaigns, not so that you can repeat them, but so that you can draw little bits from here and there that will help you in a current situation.
Yeah, and I think it's true. Myth and storytelling in general can have a really profound impact. I've thought a lot about that in relation to, I'm a Star Trek fan. I love Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Oh, me too.
Yeah,
I can. I'm doing the Vulcan welcome hand sign right now.
There you go. Yeah, yeah, and. But, you know, I grew up during Apollo and Star mm-hmm. Trek, and mm-hmm. as I look back, I realize how much kind of the combination of those things shaped, you know, the mythology of Star Trek, sort of the future mythology, shaped my way of thinking of how I thought humanity should be. And I carry that with me to this day. I still, you know, kind of the Federation is sort of, you know, and of course, there are a lot of people who have written arguments of the Federation is just an extension of neoliberalism and this kind of thing. But there's something about that way of looking at the world that has very much, it powerfully shaped the way I see things.
I agree completely. I'm from the same generation. I grew up with the same things. I can remember my folks waking me up during the middle of the night to watch the fuzzy image of Neil Armstrong step out on the moon. I watched the the Star Trek, the original Star Trek in reruns. I probably watched every one of those 24 times. And by the way, as a real geek, Spock was my hero, not Kirk.
Mine too.
Yeah. Yeah. But it does shape things. Now, and interestingly, yeah. Gene Roddenberry, who had a very, you know, idealistic utopian view, and that's the way he structured the Federation, was a World War II bomber pilot. He saw some of the worst of humanity. So, you know, it's interesting to speculate about how that shaped his kind of swing towards the idealism side. And, you know, even the Star Trek franchise has gotten a little bit more gritty over the years and a little less pristine in its idealism. I still love it and Star Wars, and I still read science fiction on a monthly basis.
Yeah, I'm the same way. And then I'm entirely hooked on Discovery and Picard and all of the other things. And so,
and as a scientist, I look at science fiction as being a very clear thought leader. As a scientist in working on search for extraterrestrial intelligence and space exploration, there's no idea that probably hasn't been very well explored by a science fiction writer already. So that, you know, on any new area in that vein, I go there first as basic research.
Yeah, it makes sense. It because there's creativity there, and that creativity, of course, it's also creativity that kind of goes out of the box. Again, back to that kind of issue of humility. One of the things we tend to do is we get confined by our boxes that we live in, and people who write science fiction, they push out of those boxes, and that can really cause us to think in new ways. Yeah. So let me ask you a question. I'm curious, you know, a little shift here, but, you know, having had the long career in the military, I'm curious what you think organizations outside of the military might learn about how the military handles errors and problems. And, you know, I'm thinking here about miscalculations from, say, a strategic perspective. You know, military planners and strategists obviously don't always get it right. And so, you know, what kinds of attitudes and ideas do you think contribute to getting things wrong in those areas? And what might we learn from that?
Ooh, that's a rich area to dive into. Let me think here. So, first of all, it's been kind of interesting for me to watch this. There's a very healthy cross flow between business academics and military leadership academics. And each one tends to look at the other for new ideas and new perspectives. So in the military, I read a lot of business leadership stuff in my professional military education. And having also been in the civilian academic world, I've seen that it kind of flips around to some degree in the business schools that do look at, and in the business, you know, leadership, publishing industry, there's a lot of looking towards the military. So it's kind of interesting how that goes back and forth. There are the U.S. military I can speak relatively well for, in that it works very hard to not fight the last war, which is very easy to do in military circumstances. It's not easy. Well, typically, a military, when it comes out of a war, winning or losing, looks at that experience and, you know, adjusts for what it learned there and then kind of sets it in stone. But the problem is, in the military, like in anything, you have to keep evolving, keep reinventing yourself, or as opposed to your business failing, your country ends or a lot of people die. So the stakes are a little bit higher. But, and I think this is true of many militaries nowadays, but the U.S. in particular that I know best works very hard at trying to what if the future and scenario, war game things to not get stuck in that box. It's not easy to do. And you still very easily fall back into that. Oh, but this worked last time. We'll just do that again. And again, I think you're seeing some of that play out in the world today, right now. So there's that aspect of a very conscious effort that's spread out throughout to try to do that. in the business world, I think the analogy is the startups or companies that form a little subgroup that's allowed to make errors, to not turn a profit immediately so that it can experiment. Some of the most successful companies, as I understand, on the more technical side, encourage their employees to spend anywhere from 5 to 20% of their time on creative thinking, on something they want to work on, not what the company's telling them to do. In the military, that's a little harder to do, but where I've been able to, I try to carve out innovation space and space to be wrong, because you absolutely have to have room to fail. And that's what training and education and professional education should do. One of the most valuable kind of learning experiences I got was in a flying organization. You typically deploy places at different times of the year to practice just that. Oh, we're going to practice the equivalent of going to a new country, setting up a base from scratch, and flying out of there. And you do that all the time in training. Well, you typically don't send your squadron commanders there. You pick someone who doesn't have a current command position but has promise, and you give them command of that deployment. So you're giving them a fixed scope in time and space and resources to essentially be a leader and exercise pretty much the entire skill set. Now, frequently, you'll put someone else nearby who is a more experienced leader, but not in charge of that operation, but someone who can just kind of keep an eye, make sure they stay in bounds, that kind of thing. And so, again, I think it comes back to a mixture of, and by the time you've gotten there, you have done a lot of study. So I don't want to say don't do study, don't do book study, whatever it is that works for you, whether it's watching movies that have great leadership examples or bad ones, you can learn just as much from bad as good. Or it's reading or whatever works for you. But I don't want to degrade the advanced study. But then you put it into practice in a fairly controlled but fairly responsible position. Those were great experiences for me in developing the ability to make decisions, to have a reasonable amount of confidence without being overconfident. Those kinds of things, I think, are really good and transfer well. And then the last thing I'll mention, which exists formally in the Army side, a little less formally in the Air side, but red teaming. And what red teaming is it's a little subgroup, typically in a headquarters staff, whose job is to essentially play devil's advocate on everything. They're there to play the enemy, to poke holes in your plans, your theories, all of that. And I think that's just very, very healthy to do. I don't know if that exists in the business world. I'm pretty confident it doesn't exist in the academic world.
Oh, no.
But boy, is that high payoff for having a handful of personnel working on that kind of thing. And, you know, one last little tidbit, another one of those old sayings that has a lot of power. No plan survives contact with the enemy. You know, again, if you're overconfident, you're going to meet with failure. You have to plan. I think it's Eisenhower said, planning is everything, but the plan is nothing, or something close to that. You've got a plan so that you can kind of think it through, but you can't be hidebound by it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, the idea of the red teaming, it's basically building into the structure of the organization a sense that you need to have gadflies that undermine everything so that you can see the sort of the flashpoints where things might go wrong. You definitely don't see that in the academic world. I think often gadflies in the academic world are looked at pretty badly by administrators because they seem to get in the way.
Yeah. I know by no means is the military or DOD perfect. I could do a multi-hour rant on the problems we have and the flaws. And it does come out, and there are some great historical examples of major war game exercises where, you know, the good guys got their rear ends kicked really hard because the guy playing the enemy thought of something really creative. And then the higher up say, well, no, you can't do that. That's not allowed. Well, that's not a wise thing to do. And it's a rarity, but boy, there are some very famous cases internally to the military about that happening as examples of how to be closed-minded and arrogant.
Yeah. And once you take that position, then you're basically closing the doors to the unexpected. You're basically saying only the expected is what can come, and you're pretty much screwed at that point.
Most definitely. Yes.
Yeah. Well, we're coming kind of to the close of our hour. Is there anything else that you'd like to add about this topic that we haven't touched on?
Oh, gosh, that went fast.
Really fast. Yeah.
Oh, there's so many different follow-ons, but let me think here. You know, I come back to the things of have perspective, you know, other than your own. My wife is originally from a different country, and the perspective of someone who didn't grow up in the same culture as me is so valuable. I still do it. I still will sometimes react instinctively and go, "What are you talking about?" But you know, I've learned over a long time being married to quickly put that away and go, "Well, and we explore a topic," and it's so refreshing. It's again about, I think it does come back. I never thought of it explicit in these terms, but intellectual humility of there are different perspectives on things that happen in the world, on you know, what's moral, what's not, you name it, what's good food and what's not. But you know, there's perspective, having that ties into humility, having an open mind, thinking creatively, reserving that time for yourself to daydream, read fiction, whatever it takes to take you out of your current world and put you into someone else's shoes, is really a great thing. So I'll stop at that.
Well, I agree. And of course I also, you know, share, my wife also is not from the United States, and living with someone who's from a different, you know, culture is always something that leads you to think about, oh, there's another way to do this. And of course, you know, as an anthropologist, that's been my basically bread and butter for most of my career, is to try to put myself in the shoes of someone else and say, well, how do they see the world? And it is a very humbling thing to do. You know, the more you see from someone else's perspective, the more you realize, oh, this, my way is not the only way to do this.
I have one more little perspective that's, I think, a little bit unique to my education background that has helped me a lot. And that is, I think of myself as an experimental physicist. I'm not a theoretician as such. I like to go out and do experiments, do real world things. And what that has deeply ingrained in me is that I don't have to have the 100% correct answer to start with. I'm quite happy to take a shot, get close, and then adjust and iterate based on feedback. So I don't know if that's a widespread thing or not, but I feel like I've acquired that from being an experimental scientist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of openness to take a shot, see where it goes, and go, oh, that didn't work, let's go over here and see where it goes. Yeah, I think it's powerful, and it's a powerful way to kind of come back and sort of, it brings back that ability to have that kind of reflexive quality, because you keep thinking, well, there must be another way to do this that might be a little better or a little different or something like that. Yeah. Well, this is, as always, this has been a lot of fun, Ken. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I just want to thank you so much for joining me on the New Books Network and on this podcast for How to Be Wrong. As always, you know, you just have a lot of really fascinating ideas, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. This has been a blast, and I look forward to more and more of the podcast. Thank you.